Okay, so we'll kind of switch a little bit over to Moggallana for this evening's reading and talk a little bit about his time, his teachings, or his example. And then after that, we'll finish up the second part of the Mahavidala Sutta, Majjhima 43. So we got the gist of Sariputta and Moggallana's trajectory from when they had their first decision to go forth, and the search they made, spending time with Sanjaya, and then discovering the Buddha via Venerable Asaji, and talked yesterday a bit about Sariputta's enlightenment and some of his teachings. So just a short bit. There's less in the suttas, less in the stories, the canon, the Vinaya about Moggallana than there is about Sariputta, but still have enough to give an idea of who he was. So there's just a short paragraph here on his enlightenment. And as I mentioned yesterday, as soon as he took ordination with the Buddha, he went off on his own for 1 week, and then by that time realized the fruits of arahantship. So this is from Great Disciples of the Buddha, page 78. Moggallana, however, for reasons not specified in the texts, resorted to a forest near the village of Kalawalaputta, in Magadha. With great zeal, he meditated there while sitting or walking up and down. But despite his determination, he was often overcome by sleepiness. Though he struggled to keep his body erect and his head upright, he kept on drooping and nodding. There were times when he could keep his eyes open only by sheer force of will. The tropical heat, the strain of his long years of a wandering life, and the inner tensions he had gone through all bore down on him at once. And thus, at the very end of his quest, his body reacted by fatigue. And that was when the Buddha realized what was going on and projected himself, or he appeared before Moggallana in the famous sutta that Ajahn Yanako already read out earlier about, "Are you nodding, Moggallana? Are you nodding?" And then he gave him instructions on different techniques to help with that. So essentially, just to sum it up, after those instructions, he continued to practice and realized arahantship after a week. That's really all there is to say about that. So as I mentioned before, too, Moggallana, Mahamoggallana was, as much as Sariputta was known for his incisive wisdom, Mahamoggallana was known for his development of the psychic powers, many different ranges of psychic powers that come from developing samadhi to a very high level. If one desires to develop them and turns one's mind to it with that level of samadhi, then one can develop any one or many of the paranormal faculties, the super knowledges. And Moggallana was supreme with that. And so I just thought I'd go through a few, mention them, and a little bit of an example, since that was his, what he was particularly known for. And there's a number of stories in the suttas regarding that. So this is on page 88, Moggallana's psychic powers. In the eyes of its early Western interpreters, many of whom saw in Buddhism a rational alternative to Christian dogmatism, Buddhism was essentially a pragmatic code of psychological ethics, free from the traditional trappings of religion. In their understanding, the suprarational side of Buddhism was dispensable, and the wonders and marvels so conspicuous in the canon and commentaries, when not overlooked, were explained away as later interpolations. But while it is true that early Buddhism does not ascribe the same significance to supernatural events as does Christianity, To insist on expunging the miraculous altogether from Buddhism is to tailor the Dhamma to fit external standards rather than to accept it on its own terms. The Pali Suttas, as a matter of course, frequently ascribe supernormal powers to the Buddha and his Arahant disciples. And there is little ground apart from personal prejudice for supposing such passages to be interpolations. Although the Buddha compares the miracle of psychic powers unfavorably with the, quote, the miracle of instruction, he does so not to detract from their reality, but only to highlight their limited value. Nevertheless, when the suttas are considered in their totality, the clear conclusion emerges that the acquisition of paranormal powers was regarded as a positive good, which serves to enhance the stature and completeness of the spiritually accomplished person. The Buddha was well aware of the dangers of being sidetracked by fascination with psychic powers. For those whose minds were still fired by personal ambition, they could be a frightful pitfall, serving to enhance the delusion of a separate selfhood and the drive for domination. But for those who had seen through the unreality of I and mine, and whose hearts were rich in compassion, such powers could be valuable tools in the service of the dispensation. Okay, so to review some of Moggallana's accomplishments in that area. First one here is penetration of others' minds, thought reading. Once on an Uposatha day, the Buddha sat silently in front of the assembly of monks. At each watch of the night, Ananda requested him to recite the code of monastic discipline, the Patimokkha, but the Buddha remained silent. Finally, when dawn came, he only said, "This assembly is impure." Thereupon, Moggallana surveyed with his mind the entire assembly and saw one monk sitting there who was, quote, immoral, wicked, of impure and suspect behavior, rotten within, lustful and corrupt. He went up to him and told him to leave three times. When the monk did not move even after the third request, Moggallana took him by the arm, led him out of the hall, and bolted the door. Then he begged the Exalted One to recite the Patimokkha, as the assembly was now pure again. The divine ear, Moggallana had the divine ear, a clairaudience. With the divine ear, Moggallana could also hear the voices of non-human beings, deities, spirits, etc., and receive messages from them. So, for instance, a spirit had warned him against Devadatta, who harbored evil intentions toward the Buddha and was plotting against him. Moggallana also had the divine eye, clairvoyance, and was able to perceive many things over a long distance. There's a great story involving he and Sariputta, which I'll leave till the end of this, regarding that particular ability of the divine eye. He also had abilities to travel by mind-made body, which sometimes called astral travel, and telekinesis, supernormal locomotion. Moggallana also had mastery over what appears to be solid matter. Once the monks staying at a monastery were negligent, busying themselves too much with material trifles. Learning of this, the Buddha asked Moggallana to use a feat of supernormal power in order to shake them out of their complacency and inspire them to return to serious striving. In response, Moggallana pushed the building with his big toe so that the entire monastery, called the Mansion of Migara's Mother, shook and trembled as if there were was an earthquake. The monks were so deeply stirred by this event that they shook off their worldly interests and again became receptive to the Buddha's instructions. The Buddha explained to them that the source of Moggallana's great supernormal prowess was the development of the four roads to power. Once Moggallana visited Sakka in the heavenly realm, in his heavenly realm, and saw that he was living rather lightheartedly. Captivated by heavenly sense pleasures, he had become forgetful of the Dhamma. To dispel his vanity, Moggallana used his toe to shake Sakka's celestial palace, called the Banner of Victory, in which Sakka took much pride. This had a shock effect on Saka too, and he now recalled the teaching on the extinction of craving, which the Buddha had briefly taught him not long ago. It was the same teaching that the Buddha had given to Moggallana as a spur to attaining arahantship. The power of transformation is another one of the powers. And I won't read this whole section, but it was essentially what he used in the battle against a formidable opponent, the royal Naga Nandopananda. And he basically was able to assume the form of a Naga to begin his challenge to Nandopananda. And then eventually, in the last phase of the battle, he assumed the form of a Suppana, the celestial eagle, which is the arch enemy of the Naga. And at that point, Nandopananda capitulated, and Moggallana, assuming once again the form of a monk, brought him to the Buddha in triumph and elicited from him an apology. So, always polite. So that's just an example of some of the ways that Moggallana was able to use his many psychic powers for the benefit of the Sangha, after his enlightenment, of course. Nice little story of regarding Mahamoggallana's ability to use the divine eye, clairvoyance. Once, when Sariputta was living with Moggallana at Kapotakandara, he was sitting in meditation out in the open air on a full moon night, his head freshly shaved. A malicious demon, Yaka, passing overhead, in a spiteful mood, descended and gave the elder a severe blow on the head. But he was so deeply absorbed in meditation that he suffered no harm. The story continues. This is from the Udana. The Venerable Mahamoggallana saw the incident, approached the Venerable Sariputta, and asked him, "Friend, are you comfortable? Are you doing well? Does nothing trouble you?" "I am comfortable, friend Moggallana," said the Venerable Sariputta. "I am doing well, but I have a slight headache." Thereupon the Venerable Mahamoggallana said, "It is wonderful, friend Sariputta. It is marvelous, friend Sariputta. How great is the psychic power and might of the Venerable Sariputta. For just now, friend Sariputta, a certain demon gave you a blow on the head. And such a mighty blow it was that it might have felled an elephant or split a mountain peak. But the Venerable Sariputta says only this, 'I am comfortable, friend Moggallana. I am doing well, friend Moggallana, but I have a slight headache.'" Then the Venerable Sariputta replied, "It is wonderful, friend Moggallana. It is marvelous, friend Moggallana. How great is the psychic power and might of the Venerable Moggallana that he should see any demon at all. As for me, I have not seen so much as a mud sprite." So I think that's a lovely little vignette of their recognition of each other's good qualities and their own humility in that. Another incident that's a classic. This one starts in is in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 50. Called the Rebuke to Mara. And I'm just going to read the first part of it and then summarize the rest. "Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Venerable Maha Moggallana was living in the Bhaga country at Sungsungma Ragira in the Besakala Grove, the deer park. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Maha Moggallana was walking up and down in the open. And on that occasion, Mara, the evil one, went into the Venerable Maha Moggallana's belly and entered his bowels. Then the Venerable Maha Moggallana considered thus, 'Why is my belly so heavy? One would think it is full of beans.' Thus he left the walk and went into his dwelling, where he sat down on a seat made ready. When he sat down, he gave thorough attention to himself, and he saw that Mara, the evil one, had gone into his belly and entered his bowels. When he saw this, he said, 'Come out, evil one, come out, evil one. Do not harass the Tathagata. Do not harass the Tathagata's disciple, or it will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time.' Then Mara, the evil one, thought, "This recluse does not know me. He does not see me when he says that. Even his teacher would not know me so soon. So how can this disciple know me?" Then the Venerable Mahamoggallana said, "Even thus I know you, evil one. Do not think he does not know me. You are Mara, evil one. You were thinking thus, evil one. This recluse does not know me. He does not see me when he says that. Even his teacher would not know me so soon, so how can the disciple know me?" Then Mara, the evil one, thought, "The recluse knew me. He saw me when he said that." Whereupon he came up from the Venerable Mahamoggallana's mouth and stood against the door bar. And at that point, Mahamoggallana gives Mara a story, a teaching, which I will summarize from The Great Disciples of the Buddha. So Moggallana told him that he knew him not only on that day, but had also known him in the past, for their karmic connection was old and deep. The following is the gist of what he said. The first of the five Buddhas appearing in our fortunate aeon was Kakusanda, whose chief disciples were the arahants Vitura and Sanjiva. At that time, Moggallana was Mara, by the name Mara Dusi. For Mara, too, like Mahabrahma and Sakka, is not a permanent being, but a cosmic post or office. Chief of demons, lord of the lower world, which is filled by different individuals migrating through the round of existence. At that time, Mara Dusi had a sister named Kali, whose son was to become the Mara of our age. Hence, Moggallana's own nephew then was now standing in front of him in his hut as the present Mara. When, in that past age, Moggallana was Mara, he had taken possession of a boy and made him throw a potsherd at the head of the Buddha Kakusanda's chief disciple, the arahant Vidura. The wound was a severe one, which caused blood to flow. When the Buddha Kakusanda turned around and saw this, he said, "Indeed, Mara knows no moderation here. For even in diabolical actions there might be moderation. And under the perfect one's glance, Mara Dusi's body dissolved and reappeared in the deepest hell. Just a moment earlier, he had been the overlord of all the hellish worlds, and now he himself was one of the victims. For many thousands of years, Moggallana had to suffer in hell as the karmic result of attacking an arahant. He was condemned to spend 10,000 years alone in the great hell, having a human body and the head of a fish, just like the beings in Pieter Bruegel's pictures of the hells. Whenever two lances of his torturers crossed in his heart, he would know that 1,000 years of his torment had passed. This encounter with Mara once more brought to Moggallana's mind the terrors of samsara from which he was now forever free. Soon afterwards, Moggallana felt that the time of his last existence was starting to run out. Being an arahant, he saw no reason to extend his lifespan to the end of the aeon by an act of will, and he calmly allowed impermanence to take its lawful course." So that was the beginning of Moggallana's relinquishment of the life faculty. So tomorrow I'll spend some time going through the various suttas describing Sariputta's passing, and also Moggallana's passing, and the Buddha's comments, teachings, very beautiful eulogy, remembering the two of them after they passed away. So that'll be tomorrow's readings. And for now, we can do the second half of the Mahavedala Sutta, the greater series of questions and answers between Mahakotita and Venerable Sariputta. think it's starting with right view. First, I was thinking about one of the questions a little more because it's one of the questions that I've always found kind of curious when Venerable Mahakotita asks him kind of like to compare the faculty of wisdom, panya, discernment, and the aggregate of consciousness, vijnana, asking him first if they're conjoined or disjoined, and what is the difference between them. And I read that section out. And I had always been curious, just sort of like, okay, thinking about this, and maybe others have had this kind of question too, why did Mahakotita ask that specific question? Because it seems like, okay, well, consciousness is, you know, vijnana is one of the five aggregates, and wisdom, or panya, is, say, one of the spiritual faculties, not an aggregate, you know. It's kind of like they're two different classes of descriptions of different things. The, you know, one is with the aggregates, one is with spiritual faculties, and what brought them up to comparison. And then it occurred to me, going back to the Pali, that they're both forms of knowing, panya being of the same root as vijnana, both having roots in the word jnana, which just means knowing. So Mahakotita was obviously, I think, this is my, you know, this is my conjecture anyway, that, you know, he was reviewing possibly different kinds of knowing. So the knowing of vijnana, consciousness, versus the knowing of panya and what the difference was. And then it made sense that he's then pointing out, Sariputta's then pointing out, that they are conjoined, not disjoined, but they are not, but there is a difference between them in that wisdom is to be developed as a spiritual faculty. It's something that you can actually put your attention to develop and increase. So it's a fabrication, in a sense. Consciousness, vijnana, divided knowing, is kind of a resultant condition of the aggregates. So that the duty, it's not something that you manufacture or produce like panya, but it's something that you have to know and understand so that you aren't fooled by it being the trickster, which is described in the suttas and other places, consciousness being sort of the magician's trick. So it needs to be understood. It's a form of knowing that's a resultant condition of having the aggregates. So I thought, oh, okay, maybe that's the reason, because they have that both have that root in knowing. So let's pick up where we left off in the questions and answers. Right view. Friend, this is Mahakotita asking Sariputta. Friend, how many conditions are there for the arising of right view? Friend, there are two conditions for the arising of right view: the voice of another and wise attention. These are the two conditions for the arising of right view. Just as a footnote, that's also, what the Buddha calls the most important external and internal factors for developing the practice, the view, the external one being the voice of another, meaning spiritual friendship, essentially, wise being wise people, and then the most important internal factor for developing the path, yoniso manasikara, wise attention, attending appropriately. Friend, by how many factors is right view assisted when it has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its fruit and benefit, and when it has deliverance by wisdom for its fruit, deliverance by wisdom for its fruit and benefit? Friend, right view is assisted by five factors when it has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its fruit and benefit, when it has deliverance by wisdom for its fruit, deliverance by wisdom for its fruit and benefit. Here, friend, right view is assisted by virtue, learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. Serenity and insight being vipassana being insight, and samatha, samatha and vipassana, serenity and insight. So virtue, learning, discussion, samatha and vipassana. Right view, assisted by these five factors, has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its fruit and benefit. It has deliverance by wisdom for its fruit, deliverance by wisdom for its fruit and benefit. And those deliverance of mind being cetto vimutti, and deliverance by wisdom being panya vimutti. Next question. Friend, how many kinds of being are there? There are these three kinds of being, friend: sense sphere being, fine material being, and immaterial being. Friend, how is renewal of being in the future generated? Friend, renewal of being in the future is generated through the delighting in this and that on the part of beings who are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Friend, how is renewal of being in the future not generated? Friend, with the fading away of ignorance, with the arising of true knowledge, and the cessation of craving, renewal of being in the future is not generated. And that just brings to memory a very famous stanza by Sariputta in another teaching, another sutta, where he says, Nibbana is the cessation of being, or the cessation of becoming, is another translation for bhava. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. And then there's a question about first jhana, which is basically just a standard description of first jhana. Five faculties. Friend, these five faculties each have a separate field, a separate domain, and do not experience each other's field and domain. That is, the eye faculty, the ear faculty, the nose faculty, the tongue faculty, and the body faculty. Now, of these five faculties, each having a separate field, a separate domain, not experiencing each other's field and domain, what is their resort? What experiences their fields and domains? Friend, these five faculties each have a separate field, a separate domain, and do not experience each other's field and domain. That is, the eye faculty, the ear faculty, the nose faculty, the tongue faculty, and the body faculty. Now, these five faculties, each having a separate field, a separate domain, not experiencing each other's field and domain, have mind as their resort, and mind experiences their fields and domains. Friend, as to these five faculties, that is, the eye faculty, the ear faculty, the nose faculty, the tongue faculty, and the body faculty, what do these five faculties stand in dependence on? Friend, as to these five faculties stand in dependence on vitality. Friend, what does vitality stand in dependence on? Vitality stands in dependence on heat. I think vitality is another word for like the general life force. Friend, what does heat stand in dependence on? Heat stands in dependence on vitality. Just now, friend, we understood the Venerable Sariputta to have said vitality stands in dependence on heat, and now we understand him to say heat stands in dependence on vitality. How should the meaning of these statements be regarded? In that case, friend, I shall give you a simile, for some wise men here understand the meaning of a statement by means of a simile. Just as when an oil lamp is burning, its radiance is seen in dependence on its flame, and its flame is seen in dependence on its radiance, so too, vitality stands in dependence on heat, and heat stands in dependence on vitality. Vital formations. Friend, are vital formations things that can be felt, or are vital formations one thing and things that can be felt another. Vital formations, friend, are not things that can be felt. If vital formations were things that can be felt, then a bhikkhu who has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling would not be seen to emerge from it. Because vital formations are one thing and things that can be felt another, a bhikkhu who has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling can be seen to emerge from it. Friend, when this body is bereft of how many states, is it then discarded and forsaken, left lying senseless like a log? Friend, when this body is bereft of three states, vitality, heat, and consciousness, it is then discarded and forsaken, left lying senseless like a log. Friend, what is the difference between one who is dead, who has completed his time, and a bhikkhu who has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling? Friend, in the case of one who is dead, who has completed his time, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided. His verbal formations have ceased and subsided. His mental formations have ceased and subsided. His vitality is exhausted, his heat has been dissipated, and his faculties are fully broken up. In the case of a bhikkhu who has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided. His verbal formations have ceased and subsided. His mental formations have ceased and subsided. But his vitality is not exhausted. His heat has not been dissipated, and his faculties become exceptionally clear. This is the difference between one who is dead, who has completed his time, and a bhikkhu who has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling. Friend, how many conditions are there for the attainment of the neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind? Friend, there are four conditions for the attainment of the neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Here, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. These are the four conditions for the attainment of the neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Friend, how many conditions are there for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind? Remember Antony's question yesterday? Friend, there are two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind: non-attention to all signs and attention to the signless element. These are the two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind. Animita Cheto Vimuti, which is the continuance from Animita Samadhi, concentration. Friend, how many conditions are there for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind? Friend, there are three conditions for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind: non-attention to all signs, attention to the signless element, and the prior determination of its duration. These are the three conditions for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind. Friend, how many conditions are there for the emergence from the signless deliverance of mind? Friend, there are two conditions for emergence from the signless deliverance of mind: attention to all signs and non-attention to the signless element. These are the two conditions for emergence from the signless deliverance of mind. Yeah, I'm going to skip over a little bit because we're starting to run out of time here. I want to leave a little time if there are some questions. He goes on to talk about the immeasurable deliverance of mind and how the two differ. The immeasurable deliverance being basically full development of the Brahma Viharas. And then on to deliverance of mind through nothingness and deliverance of mind through emptiness, other deliverances of mind. Leave people to read that on their own. And I'll finish up with just the last few comments about this particular question, because it kind of sums it up. And what, friend, is the way in which these states are now are one in meaning and different only in name? Lust is a maker of measurement. Hate is a maker of measurement. Delusion is a maker of measurement. In a bhikkhu whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Of all the kinds of immeasurable deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, void of delusion. Lust is a maker of signs. Hate is a maker of signs. Delusion is a maker of signs. Again, in a bhikkhu whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Of all the kinds of signless deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, void of delusion. This is the way in which these states are one in meaning and different only in name. So to summarize that long question and answer, these variable forms of citta vimutti, deliverance or emancipation, freedom, release, are all still part of fabrications and conditions in and of themselves. But when they're accompanied by the unshakable deliverance of mind, in other words, full liberation by wisdom, then it becomes, all of them become unshakable if it's accompanied by that deliverance by wisdom. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The Venerable Maha Kotita was satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. So again, the reason for reading this sutta was just to give everybody an example of the great breadth and depth of Venerable Sariputta's understanding, as mentioned, second only to the Buddha's penetration with wisdom. So I'll leave that there for the reading tonight and see if there's any comments or questions.
So the lesser deliverances could just be likened to insights, whereas the unshakable deliverance could be like super mundane path knowledge?
More than insight, really, the various forms of citta vimutti are actually, experiences and one could say attainments of a certain nature that do result in vimutti, which is release. It's just that they are still conditioned. They're still fabricated. They're not the result of penetration by insight. So for as long as they're lasting, as long as one has fabricated them, and is dwelling with them, there is that sense of release, of relinquishment, of emancipation, in a sense, freedom from suffering. But the root causes of greed, hatred, and delusion, at least to some extent, are still present. And when that fabricated state of mind, whether it's the Brahma-viharas or even something like the emptiness emancipation or the signless emancipation, when the causes and conditions for those having been established run their course, then the greed, hatred, and delusion that are at the core of our confusion and suffering are still there to manifest in different ways. I would say that it's beyond insight that these forms of citta vimutti are. They're definitely very strong forms of peace and freedom. But again, because the root causes of suffering have not been eradicated, then they're subject to dissolution when the causes and conditions wear out. Sometimes it's an interesting point because sometimes people get confused with the words like citta vimutti and panna vimutti, which you often see presented together, and that they think that, citta vimutti means full liberation having used concentration or psychic powers or different kinds of things like that. And that Panya Vimutti is like dry insight. You know, you hear that term from the commentaries, you know, which is liberation through you know, insight, and that there's two kinds of, or two ways to attain full liberation using that path of Chaito Vimutti or Panya Vimutti. But actually, that seems to be an incorrect interpretation, in that Chaito Vimutti is, through the suttas, is generally considered to be, like I said, that temporary, conditioned, fabricated freedom of mind. And that a person doesn't necessarily have to have developed all the full range of mind development to attain liberation through wisdom, Panya Vimutti. But it is only when a person has fully seen clearly through wisdom and abandoned the three root causes of greed, hatred, and delusion that one can be said to be completely free.